from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. What can possibly prepare you to host a weekly news quiz for that most discriminating of all audiences, the public radio crowd? Studying theater at Harvard, writing for a motorcycle magazine, or perhaps being an extra in a Michael Jackson video? These experiences and more seem to have served Peter Sagal very well. As the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sagal has charmed audiences for the past 14 years with his quick wit, easygoing stage presence, and of course, his wry sense of humor. It's KCPW's good fortune to host the return of Wait, Wait to Salt Lake City next month, and today on the program, Peter Sagal joins me to talk about his game show adventure. Plus, a sneak peek at the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me concert poster. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Well, it's no secret that KCPW has stared into the financial abyss over the past few months, and during our desperate on-air pleas for financial support last October, one particular KCPW listener and fan responded. The caller was Peter Sagal, host of NPR's hit weekly news quiz Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and we're taking him up on his generous offer to help and bringing him back to Salt Lake City next month. Today on the program, Peter Sagal joins us to talk about his affection for KCPW, his love of Utah Powder, and his tremendous success with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter Sagal, thanks so much for your time today. We really appreciate your being with us this morning.
I resent having to be here. I just want to disagree with you. This description of me as a generous and kind person. I'm going to argue with you. I was dragged in here kicking and screaming, and frankly, I'd rather be anywhere else. Hello, Jennifer. How are you?
Good Monday morning to you as well.
Yes, I am a little grumpy.
Peter Sagal has been the host of NPR's celebrated quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me since 1998. He's also been a stage director, an actor, an extra in a Michael Jackson video, a travel writer, and an author of numerous plays, as well as a book, The Book of Vice, published by HarperCollins.
Under his direction, about that in Utah.
Under his direction, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has become one of the most popular shows on public radio, heard by nearly 3 million listeners on over 500 public radio stations nationwide, including KCPW. And Peter Sagal joins us from NPR studios at WBEZ in Chicago. We can't wait to have you here next month, Peter Sagal.
I can't wait to come back to drop my feigned grumpiness. I love Salt Lake and am very happy to come back and see all you guys on the Wasatch Front.
Later on in the program, we'll talk with the man behind the super cool screen print announcing the upcoming Wait, Wait event, graphic designer Travis Bone. But first, Peter Sagal, he's bringing the whole cast and crew to Abravanel Hall in Salt Lake City Thursday, February 16th, and you can get more information on that event on our website, kcpw.org. If you've got behind-the-scenes questions about producing Wait, Wait, or just want the dirt on Carl Castle, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Peter Sagal, as I mentioned, you were very gracious in offering to help KCPW during our hour of need, which unfortunately is much longer than an hour, but we're certainly grateful. Why come to the rescue of this little public radio station? Why does KCPW hold a special place in your heart?
Well, this requires a little bit of history of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I need to explain. But you guys, KCPW in particular, had an incredibly important role in the success of our program. When the show began in January of 1998, we just celebrated our 14th anniversary, we were a studio show. We had been created that way. We did the show in a studio, so when the show began, I was in one studio here in Chicago, Carl Castle in another in Washington, our panelists, wherever they happened to be, Boston, L.A. Callers came in, and it was all in a studio. There was no audience. And this was done for a lot of reasons that seemed good at the time, easier to edit, easier to control, easier to get people involved if they didn't have to leave their cities. But it never occurred to anyone that if you're doing a comedy show, it might be a really good idea to have people around who can laugh at you so as to make it sound funny. And we proceeded to do the show in the manner that in which we did. And then in late 1999, or mid-1999, a gentleman by the name of Chris Eisenberg from KCPW, called us up and said, we would love for you to do a show with us in front of a live audience here in Salt Lake. And he and you guys collectively provided everything we'd need. You got us out there, the planes, you sent the KCPW jet, which was very nice.
I seem to recall driving you in my deluxe Mazda from the airport.
Yes, so. I do remember being picked up. And at that time, we were like, wow, they came to get us at the airport. We're so special. It's a Mazda. And we did the show in an auditorium at Westminster Hall. And it's kind of Westminster College, excuse me. And it's kind of crazy to say this now that we've, sold out Carnegie Hall a couple times and various other landmarks on our success. But we had no idea if anybody would want to come see us. It was early on in our evolution. We weren't sure about, the audience's affection for us. We had maybe nationally 200,000 or 300,000 listeners. And we had no idea if it would work. And it was really your guys' enthusiasm that convinced us to give this a try. And we did it. And I listened to it a little while ago. And I am incredibly awkward. I'm shouting at people. There's a tendency when you see a lot of people in front of you to forget that there's a very powerful microphone in front of you and you just shout. And we made various other errors, but nonetheless, we did the show and people enjoyed it. You guys in Salt Lake were, I think, the ideal audience because, as might have been pointed out in other contexts, you folks are really nice. And you were very nice to us. And we did the show, and I remember just this feeling as we came off stage at the end and we're greeting people like, wow, we should do this all the time. And now we do. It took a while to arrange it to make it so that we do the show in front of an audience all the time. It took 5 years, in fact. But it was really that idea, that experience that started us on the course to, where we are today. Mm. So I remain very grateful.
I mentioned you went to Harvard. You were an extra in a Michael Jackson music video. You wrote for a motorcycle magazine.
I did those things.
What's the one thing that best prepared you to become this lovable game show host that you are?
A lot of social ostracism in high school. Pretty much because, or maybe even earlier in junior high school and elementary school, because I wasn't very athletic and I didn't have a lot. I didn't have a lot of other, shall we say, impressive personal attributes, so I relied on being funny to make my way. This is a common experience among comedians and writers and other professionals that it's just something that they could do. And it, I'm kind of not kidding in that I managed my way through high school both socially and academically by being clever at the last minute. And I developed a persona or an intellectual capacity to be funny about anything quickly, but at limited length, right? Mm. So if you bring up any topic, I can probably be amusing and even informed about it for about 35 to 40 seconds.
And that's all it takes, right?
And that's really, and it turns out in a public radio quiz show like the one I host, that's really all you need because, a minute later, we're off to something else. So that's basically it. I mean, I once did one of those internet things where you're supposed to fill out, what my ideal job would be. And I had to sit down and think about it, and I realized I actually have my ideal job for that reason.
You're a lucky man.
I am.
You certainly have a lot of experience on the stage. You've written plays, you've acted. So I guess in some ways a game show host is not too far removed. But in this particular context, it's a news quiz show, not a light assignment. And it's on NPR, so people do listen to the news. As host of Wait, Wait, has it forced you to listen to the news in a different way, knowing that you are going to be on the spot every week?
Well, it does in a weird way. I mean, I should tell you that I got this job. I had no experience in radio. I compare myself to, say, Ira Glass, who, as you may know, the legend of Ira, started cutting tape as an intern at 18 at NPR in Washington and did every single job there is to do in radio, producing and reporting and recording and engineering before he finally developed over the years enough credibility and experience and expertise to host his own show. I didn't do any of that, so ha-ha, Ira, burn on you. I stumbled into it, and I stumbled into it because a friend of mine heard that NPR was putting on a new show, and they were looking for, quote, funny people who read a lot of newspapers, and he thought of me. The fact of the matter is that I was a writer professionally at that time, and like all normally constituted writers, I spent most of my time procrastinating, and my preferred method of procrastinating was reading the newspaper and listening to NPR. And so I, am just the kind of guy who just is filled with little tidbits about the news because that's what I soak up all day. in a weird way, my hobby became my job. So now when I procrastinate, I do things like, you know, file my receipts, I guess. I have no idea what it is to do, because basically I'm just somebody who's constantly sort of sucking up the news all the time. For Wait, my tastes had to change in that, you know, in addition to the big news of the day, you know, the politicians and the scandals and Rick Perry not being able to remember the Third Department and that sort of thing, we do a lot of material, as you might know, about the really odd stuff. So I sort of sniff out the people who are, like, stuffing weasels in their pants when they cross into the country and customs. I mean, that's the sort of thing that I have to pay attention to now. And I tend to ignore, like, the big serious stories because we don't make fun of them. So, you know, tsunamis, like, who cares about that? Has anybody stuffed a weasel in their pants? That's basically my news-consuming mantra.
So you're looking for those weird news of the day kind of stories.
We do a lot of that, as we know. We're always looking for the comedy. I mean, in a weird way, I tend to read major news stories backwards. And what I mean by that is if you open up the paper, or whatever it might be, the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, Salt Lake Papers, and there's a major story, say, you know, one of these 30 or 40 column-inch stories, the main serious thing, today President Obama did this, or today Mitt Romney, or whoever it may be, and it'll be substantive and so on and so forth about the topic, and there'll be serious quotes from experts. But at the very end is where the reporter often puts in the little detail. And while Mitt Romney was making this announcement, a ferret was looking out from under his hat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the reporter often puts it at the end, because he knows it's going to get cut if they run out of time. So I start at the end. So on our show, instead of asking, when Mitt Romney announced it, did he stress foreign trade? No. When Mitt Romney made this economic announcement, what was staring out under his hat? That's where we make our living. So I tend to read from the back.
Secrets from Peter Sagal,
yes.
Host of NPR's Wait, Don't Tell Me. Of course, he's coming to Salt Lake City next month. We'll give you some details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to give us a call. 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You've mentioned what makes a good joke and why we laugh at the news. You've also got a very reliable stable of panelists.
Yes.
From Charlie Pierce to Adam Felber to Roxanne Roberts, what do you look for in a panelist? What makes a good panelist?
It's an interesting question, actually. And sometimes I think of myself in the old Jim Phelps role in Mission Impossible, the old Mission Impossible, in which, you know, he'd start the show. Peter Graves would, like, look at the pictures and pick out people for their expertise. The fact of the matter is that the most important thing about our panelists is that we all like each other, weirdly. Because what we're doing when we do our show is we're actually having a gathering of friends who are enjoying themselves talking about the week's news. I think that's why our show is enjoyable, because we're enjoying ourselves. Whenever I talk to a special guest, I always talk to them prior to the broadcast, say Paul Feig last week, and I always say, you know, basically the more fun we have, the more fun our audience has. That's our rule. So we like people who we like. I know it's redundant, or I'm begging the question, but it's actually true. In addition, it's nice if they're very knowledgeable, very funny, very opinionated. I mean, let me take the two people you just mentioned, for at least the people you mentioned first, Charlie Pierce and Adam Felber. Charlie Pierce has, like, this incredibly steel trap mind. He knows everything. He makes me, as a master of trivia and odd detail, look like, you know, a dummy. He knows everything. He's incredibly quick, and he's incredibly opinionated. So anything that comes up, he will have knowledge, he will have an opinion, and he will throw it out there incredibly quickly, which is great. Adam, by contrast, also very smart, also very funny, trained improvisational comedian, spent 15 to 20 years doing improv in Boston and New York. And so he is an amazing ability to take something that's been offered by another panelist or by me, as I give a bit of fact from the question, and do something really funny with it and kick it back to you. He's like a great tennis partner, somebody who always hits the ball back where you can get it. Adam has this amazing ability to make everybody around him even funnier because he gives you something you can work with. And if you were to go through all of our panelists, you'd find certain, I mean, this is where we get into the Mission Impossible thing, certain things about them that they offer that are individual, that are particular. And again, the result, I hope, is that you tune into the show and you go, oh, it's these four or five people, if you count Carl and myself. Great, I get to hang out with them for a while. And, you know, I think that's the appeal of the show.
And of course, you have the venerable voice of Carl Castle, one of the most
trusted
newsmen in the business. How in the world did you get paired with Carl Castle? What was that recruiting call like?
Here's the thing about Carl Castle, and I tell this story, and I might have told it when we were in Salt Lake in 2000, so apologies if you've heard this before. And this, I think, really sums up Carl and his appeal and his enthusiasm. It was right after the show began. It was back in 1998. They flew me to Washington to pose for, among other things, pose for some publicity photographs. I look at them now. They're amusing. I have hair. And we were just standing in an unused rehearsal studio or performance studio in NPR Washington posing for pictures. And we decided, well, we're a goofy show. We should do something goofy. What should we do? There's a grand piano in the corner, right? And I say, hey, let's go over there. And we set up this shot where I'm sitting pretending to play the piano. And Carl is lying on top of the grand piano, his chin in my hand, batting his eyes at me in the manner of Michelle Pfeiffer in The Fabulous Baker Boy.
That's a beautiful image.
Ain't it, though? And keep in mind, now, Carl at this time, how old is he? He's around 65. He's an absolute, as you say, veteran newsman. He's, if anything, the most trusted voice in news, shall we say, since Walter Cronkite has retired. And there he is. And he's lying on a piano in his blazer and slacks, batting his eyes at me, being coquettish, which we didn't know was in his club bag. And he says to me, quote, you know, I've always wanted to do this. And that sums up Carl, because all those years, he was doing those news reports starting at, I think, 3 in the morning Eastern time. He really wanted to be performing. He has this background that he had to give up of doing radio theater. He was a morning DJ. In other words, what I'm telling you is that Carl Castle, beneath that very severe, if pleasant, Southern gentlemanly charm, is a big Virginia ham. And our show has given him that opportunity to explore that side as sort of a second and later career in his life. And he couldn't be happier, and I couldn't be happier for him.
Mm. Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's bringing the show to Abravanel Hall Thursday, February 16th. If you'd like to join us this morning, though, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And let's go to the phones, and Rob is joining us from Salt Lake. Rob, hi.
Hello, good morning. How are you guys?
Good morning.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, so I had a question. Considering that you're a national NPR show and there's a lot of listeners, do you guys favor news taken from NPR outlets?
Actually, weirdly, no, in a strange way. When the show began, we assumed that the NPR listeners would really want to hear audio from NPR. They'd want us to refer to questions, to stories that they had heard on NPR. So a lot of our questions were like, well, you know, on NPR this week we heard XXXY, what was that? And we discovered that that was kind of limiting because this may be, I don't mean to diss my colleagues at NPR, but they're not very funny. Mm. That's not their job. They're not out there trying to be funny. They're trying to be informative and illustrative of trends in the world today and serious and responsible journalism. So, we discovered early on that if we were looking for, and I continue to use this as an example, weasels and pants type stories, Morning Edition was simply not the place to look.
But you're not looking at The Inquirer or News of the World.
No, we're not. In fact, it's always a problem because every now and then we'll come across a story that is literally too good to be true. And when we find out it is too good to be true, i.e. it's not true, there's always this sort of dying swan moment where we're like, well, maybe it's kind of true. We could say that they said it was true, and then we all sort of look at each other and go, no. So we do try to, I mean, it is one of the things we believe, and I actually got this from Harry Shearer, is that true is always better than made up when it comes to comedy, if there's something that's true. So we try to make sure that everything we report as fact is in fact fact, that we have screwed it up from time to time. But generally speaking, we like people to understand and trust that if we say something happened, it really happened.
Rob, does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Again, we're speaking with Peter Sagal. He's the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is coming to Abravanel Hall Thursday, February 16th. You can be there. Your tickets are on sale on our website, kcpw.org, or you can buy individual tickets through ArtTix, arttix.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Peter Sagal, beloved host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, is with us talking about the show and his upcoming visit to Salt Lake City. If you've got questions for Peter about Madeleine Albright, Orrin Hatch, or any of his favorite guests, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255 or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Now that I've mentioned a couple of those guests, what is a good guest? What makes a good guest?
It's a good question. On our show, the things that we look for in someone is a kind of openness to the experience that we are doing in a weird way. We have a lot of people who have done a lot of media, to put it mildly. They're very famous. They're well known. They're maybe their movie actors or their President Bill Clinton. And there's a certain kind of way in which their public appearances go. They, you know, the top three questions they always get. And you can hear a kind of practiced response as they say, well, that's a good question, even though they've heard it many times before. Mm. And what we love to do is we love to get people off those questions. We don't want to zing them, and we don't want to surprise them and sandbag them, but we want them to be able to talk about themselves or talk about their experiences in a way they don't normally get to do and have more fun, frankly. And our greatest pleasures are when that happens, when all of a sudden you're hearing somebody on our show and you hear them say things or do things you've never heard them say before. And you hear them sort of expressing a side of themselves that you haven't heard them hear before. And so when people talk to me about like who my favorite guests are, there are really funny people. For example, we had Dave Barry on the show, and he was on a rerun. We just ran a show we taped almost a year ago in Miami. And he's really funny. But of course he's really funny. He's Dave Barry. I love it when somebody comes on our show you don't expect to be funny. Like, say, Nico Case, who is a great singer, who came on a couple years ago and was hilarious. And that I love. I love it when they, I mean, not just because they're funny, but it's like, wow, there's like this person with a sense of humor and interest. It just makes me very happy when that happens.
I want to play a clip from a previous show that you held here in Salt Lake City, and the guest was Ken Jennings.
Oh, yes.
This was back in 2006. I think he might be illustrating some of what you're talking about. This
Indeed,
is Ken Jennings back in 2006 here in Salt Lake.
They love you here.
Apparently
in Salt Lake City.
So. I guess there's a very short list of Utah celebrities, and all the Osmonds were in Branson this week. And
I know.
Here I am.
Well, let's review your achievement. This was a few years ago, 2003, am I right?
2004.
2004, that you go on Jeopardy.
Boy, you got that right.
Shortly,
he's fired up right out of the block.
Shortly, this, of course, was shortly after Jeopardy changed its rules. For many years, the rule was you could win five games in a row, and then they retired you and let other people play. But they changed the rules. You could play as long as you want. And you came on, this anonymous accountant from Salt Lake City.
Computer programmer,
excuse
actually.
Me.
Look at that, twice.
It's even nerdier than
it's
accountant,
nerdier.
If such a thing is
even
possible.
Nerdier. And just proceeded to tear that place apart, to set it on fire.
Figuratively.
You could not lose.
Except for that one.
Except
when
eventually.
I lost.
How did you prepare to go on Jeopardy? Did you practice? You must have to do that well.
Yeah, my wife and I crammed. We made flashcards, and I would often watch the show. I tried to watch it like the contestants play it. So this is going to sound pretty nerdy, but I would like stand behind my lazy boy at home, you know, figuring it was about the same height as one of those podiums, and I would hold my son's Fisher-Price ring stack toy in my right hand, figuring it was more or less the same size as the little buzzer you see people holding on TV. And
now, how could you possibly study for Jeopardy? They could ask you anything, though.
There's a few things that come up all the time, like world capitals and presidents and Shakespeare. And they often had a potent potables category. And, you know, being a Utah teetotaler, we also made flashcards on cocktails and other mixed drinks. So,
really?
So, you know, if the whole Jeopardy gig falls through, I can now tend bar. I've never tasted any of these things, but I know what's in a Singapore sling.
Excellent.
That's Ken Jennings in 2006 on the NPR quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter Sagal, was that a good guest, a good interaction?
I have no idea because I didn't hear a word of it.
Didn't come down the line,
but I hope he was very charming.
He was very charming.
Actually, Ken Jennings, first of all, was extremely charming and very funny. He was then. He is now. In fact, I've been following him on Twitter. Ken Jennings changed my life. Can I tell you this? Why?
Why?
I will tell you why he changed my life. Because I have, this may be why I'm a good person for radio, is I'm very uncomfortable being photographed. I don't like the way I look very much, particularly the way I look when I'm smiling. I think I look goofy. So for many, many years, whenever I posed for a photograph, I would just put on a stern expression because I thought that was more becoming. And someone took a picture of me with Ken backstage at that show. And, you know, it's digital, so I could see it right away. And I said, there I am, standing next to Ken Jennings, looking like I am constipated and sucking on a prune. What is wrong with me? That is an unhappy person. If nobody can be happy standing next to Ken Jennings, who is a cheerful and friendly guy, if there ever there was one, then that person has a problem. And ever since then, I now smile in photographs. So, Ken, if you're listening, I know you're not because you live in Seattle now, but thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Phone calls coming in, 801-355-TALK is our number if you've got questions for Peter Sagal. And Dan has been holding from Salt Lake. Dan, hi. Dan, hello? Are you there? All right. We'll go on to Miko from Salt Lake City. And Miko, hello.
Hi. Number one, I am a huge fan. I did not expect you at all to come to Salt Lake today. So thank you so much for coming by. And also, you look fine. Anyway, the question that I had was, I know you joke on your blog all the time that all you do all week is basically, you know, go to weird websites and go on your blog. But yes. I know that you guys do a lot of research, and you were talking about how you verify all your sources. So I was wondering what the ratio of the staff that you use to do the research on all these sites and verify them as opposed to writing the show.
That's a good question, actually. Thank you, because a question I get more often is, so what do you do the rest of the week? So I applaud your assumption that we actually do something the rest of the week. And by the way, I've never talked to somebody named Miko other than the deadly assassin in the Frank Miller Sin City comic books. So,
well, it's
sorry.
Also the same as the with the raccoon in Pinocchio. Sorry, not Pinocchio, but in Pocahontas.
Oh, right.
Oh.
So there you go. Anyway.
Another bit of trivia for you,
Nice
Peter.
To talk to you. The answer to your question is we have five people who work in the show editorially. Myself and four other producers who I'll name, Ian Chillog, Michael Danforth, Eva Walchover, and Emily Acton. Plus we have two technical directors, Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. And the five of us editorial staffers spend all day. I mean, that isn't a joke. We spend all day staring at our computers, going from website to website, newspaper site to newspaper site, aggregators, everything from Google News to Reddit to various blogs that specialize in politics. Everybody has their own little secret sources. And we must, and then we find stories and we send them around via email. Hey, here's one, here's one, here's one, here's one, here's one. This is funny, this is funny, this is funny. This might be funny. What do you think? Is that funny? And then we have these daily meetings. We talk about them. We pitch them to each other. I think this is funny because, wasn't it hilarious? The reason this is funny is sometimes we go at it the other way. We say, for example, this week is a good example. We're going to have the New Hampshire primary tomorrow. We're going to do something about the New Hampshire primary. We know that to begin with, so we'll start looking for the funny angle, the amusing quote for Carl to do. I mean, last week is actually maybe even a better example of the kind of work we do, particularly in regard to that reading from behind, reading from the end thing I was talking about. We wanted to do something about Michelle Bachmann. Michelle Bachmann, obviously, a character in our ongoing narrative, yet she dropped out of the race last week. Well, we on our show are not going to say, what did Michelle Bachmann do last week? She dropped out of the race. That's not our style. What our style would be, what did Michelle Bachmann's husband Marcus do the day before the primary rather than campaigning for his wife? And the answer was he shopped for doggy sunglasses. That's what we do. Now, so to answer your question, we need to find that. And we might read 50 stories before we stumble across the one with that. And once we have that, to answer your other question, we do try to verify it. We rely on, like everybody does, on the fact-checking of the various news sources. If something appears in a reputable newspaper as opposed to just a website, we'll believe it. And I believe that story was reported. Well, actually, that story was easy because that we had video of Michelle Bachmann saying it. That's how we know about it. But we will in fact check. We will double check. We've learned that on the internet especially, something can be said and can go around the world and be reported by everybody. And if you chase it back, it never really arrives at anything. It's just an example. Here's one that just leaps to mind. There was a day of a couple years ago where everybody was reporting that Bob Dylan was going to do a GPS voice for like some GPS system. And we thought this was hilarious. You know, it was like, hey, take a left turn now. You know, we were all, hey, you know, how many roads must a guy walk down to get to the Walmart? we were just like amusing ourselves to death with this, and we actually got to the day of the show when somebody checked on it and discovered that it had all started because Dylan was recording his show for satellite radio and had made a joke. Mm. And that had been picked up and reported by some desperate person on some website somewhere who needed a space filler. And that happens a lot. So we need to track those down. And as I said earlier, believe me, it's hard to let those go. But you do. You just let them float away back into the data stream.
Miko, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
801-355-TALK is our number. And Dan is back with us. Dan, hi.
Hi there. First of all, I wanted to mention that Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me was my first introductory to NPR radio.
And really?
Now I listen to everything. Even
the rest
the
of it
Car
must be
Talk guys and Kathy.
Oh, my God.
And everything.
So we're sort of a gateway drug. Is that what you're saying?
It was absolutely a gateway drug and one that keeps me happy all the time. So it's a good
drug. I'm
very
glad.
Also, I noticed I'm also a huge Saturday Night Live fan.
Yeah.
And I noticed that there are many times when a joke that you guys will tell about the news also ends up on Saturday Night Live. I was wondering if this is a coincidence. Do you have former Saturday Night Live writers on your staff, or do they listen to NPR and say, we can use that?
I hope it's not the latter, and I believe it's not. I won't mention who it was. We once got a complaint from a guy who's in this business who makes jokes about the news, saying, I made this joke, and you guys made this joke later on your show, and if you're going to steal from me, you should acknowledge it. And what we said to him is presumably what those guys at Saturday Night Live would say to us if we challenge them, which we won't, which is that, you know, we're all these people that are trying to do the same job, i.e. make jokes, out of the same material. And it's just, you can't have this many monkeys in a room banging on typewriters without coming up with similar results sometimes. You know, for example, I wrote a joke for the script that Newt Gingrich started to plummet in the polls when voters across the country realize that, oh, it's that Newt Gingrich. and that same joke, it turns out, I found out later, had appeared in like three or four other venues. There's a huge news mockery industry right now. There's not only our show, and there's Jon Stewart, there's Stephen Colbert, there's all the late-night comedians, Leno and Letterman and Fallon and those guys. There's Saturday Night Live, there's Andy Borowitz, there's all these people who are doing it on websites, there's The Onion. Somebody's going to stumble on the same joke, you know. I mean, yeah. It's just going to happen, and we don't mind. We hope if we know Stewart, say, has done a joke, then we won't make that joke because it's like, well, he got there first, and that's a bit of a problem because we're at the end of the week. But hey, as you point out, Saturday Night Live is even after us, so
right.
We get credit.
Can I ask another humor-related question?
You may
go ahead quickly.
My favorite panelists are Mo Rocca and Paula Poundstone. Are there panelists, when you get them, that you know the show's going to be just funnier than most?
We expect certain things when we get panelists. When Paula, everybody loves Paula. I love Paula. One of the things I expect with Paula is that will be no shortage of material.
Mm.
She has an endless font of information. I know with Mo that it will take a long time to answer any question I ask him because he takes a lot of time. We are very confident and very happy when any of our panelists show up, although we do know that we anticipate a different kind of character or quality when we have an individual panelist. But I love them all. They're all my favorite children.
Great.
Dan, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. And we'll go to Marilyn, who's calling us from Salt Lake City. Marilyn, hi.
Hi. I wondered how much of a heads up you give the panelists. Do you say to them, these are some of the questions we might be talking, topics we might be talking about, so they have a minute to think about it, or is it all entirely unscripted?
That's a good question. It is almost unscripted. And the little asterisk there, the almost, comes up in two ways. First of all, obviously they know what the bluff the listener story is because they prepare their own stories. And we tell them before the show what the prediction is so they can prepare something for the end of the show. Otherwise, we will sometimes say to them, oh, by the way, when we have the caller coming on at the top of the show to play Who's Carl or whatever other game we've replaced it with, we're going to be mentioning, say, Rick Perry's debate muff, say. So they know that that's going to come up. On the other hand, they already know that's going to come up. The one thing we don't do is we don't tell them anything about the questions we're going to ask them directly. Not because we care who wins or loses, we don't, but because we have found over the years through trial and error that they actually do better if they're surprised, if they don't know what's coming on. Again, I refer to the fact that our show sounds spontaneous, like a spontaneous conversation between friends, because it is, really. And we tried that once. I remember once I said to one panelist, hey, you might want to have a bit ready for this because we're going to come to you about this. And when we got to that bit, he delivered his pre-thought out bit in such a stiff and dead manner that we weren't able to use it in the show. The show has to be, I think, spontaneous for it to be genuinely what we do.
Marilyn, does that answer your question?
That answers it perfectly. And thank you also for bringing different people on the Not My Line, Not My Job part, because I think one of my top 10 funniest things I ever heard on Wait, Wait was Tom Hanks.
Oh, he was wonderful. That was
and
really
it made
great.
Me have a whole appreciation for him in a way that I never had before, because I saw him being a little boy trying to beat his siblings at whatever game they were playing. So.
I love the idea that you might have thought of Tom Hanks as a hard, cold man.
No. No, but anyway, thank you very much for all your good work.
Marilyn.
Oh, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it.
Marilyn, thanks for the call. We're speaking with Peter Sagal. He's the host, of course, of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. They are coming to Abravanel Hall Thursday, February 16th, and you can get more information about tickets and events on our website, kcpw.org. Our time is running out, but I want to squeeze in one more phone call. This is Heidi calling from Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Hello. Just like everybody else, I have to say I'm an amazing fan, and I already have my front row seat for this show.
Hey, we'll see you there. Dress up.
But I also saw that you on the ticket packages that KCPW is selling that there's an opportunity to go skiing with you. So my trivia question of the day is, how good of a skier are you?
Mm. That's a good question. And I heard about that myself, too, and I agreed to it. I don't know the details. Maybe you, Jennifer, know more about the package.
I will find out.
We will find out, and we will let everybody know. I am a mediocre skier, but I can get down the slope. Generally speaking, I can get up into like single black diamond without killing myself, and I tend to stay away from the moguls, but I am not. I am a credible, if not expert, skier. So it's not at my best. So you might see me plunge to the ground a number of times, but hopefully there'll be no major injuries.
Heidi, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Peter Sagal, Salt Lake City clearly loves you. It appears you love the place back.
I do.
What can you tell us about the upcoming show? Can you give us a sneak peek?
I actually should have prepared to do that, but I can't because I didn't check to see who's going to be on our cast there. I should have known that, and I apologize. I realized that 5 minutes ago. I can tell you that in general, our live shows, for those of you who've seen the ones we've done in Salt Lake City, we've done three. This will be our fourth. They generally are really fun. We do a lot of stuff that we can't put on the air because it's too blue or strange or weird, but people tend to really enjoy it. But mainly, I got to say, it's just a thrill for me because I, like you referred earlier, I'm a theater person. I like to see the audience. I don't believe you're out there unless I actually can see you. And it's just really exciting for all of us to come out there and hang out with you guys for an evening. And we always do hang out a little bit as well. So hopefully we'll be able to mix and match and hang out and swap war stories and stuff.
Peter Sagal, it's been a great pleasure. I look forward to seeing you next month, and congratulations on your 14th birthday with the show.
Thank you. Are you going to pick us up at the airport in your Mazda again?
Oh, you know, I may have to upgrade my car before then.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. See you all soon.
That's Peter Sagal, the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. KCPW presents a live taping of Wait, Wait Thursday, February 16th at Abravanel Hall in Salt Lake City. Again, for packages and for tickets, you can go to KCPW's website, kcpw.org. Up next, we're going to speak with the visual herald of the Wait, Wait show, the screen print designer Travis Bone. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Travis Bone has been designing concert and event posters since 2004 with a client list that includes groups from the Fleet Foxes to Bob Dylan. But now he's facing his biggest challenge, creating a screen print for KCPW's upcoming Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me event in February. Joining me now to talk about his art and inspiration is Travis Bone. He is what do I call you, Travis? A designer, an illustrator, a graphic artist?
Yeah, I guess an illustrator and a printmaker.
Okay. He lives in Salt Lake City. And Travis, it's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
If you have questions about screen printing or about inspiration, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Travis, you've been producing screen prints for the past 8 years or so, but you never really set out to become a sought-after designer, did you?
No, not really.
I understand you studied computer science.
I actually studied chemistry.
Chemistry? Okay.
Yeah. Really small, tiny chemistry.
So how did you make this transition into visual art?
Well, I've always really liked to draw. Growing up, I drew these entire armies of like Batman and Ninja Turtles and Disney movie covers for movies that never happened. And I got to an age where I realized that there wasn't any way to make money doing that, as fun as it was. So I went to college and did that for a while, but at the same time I was doing a lot of like freelance design stuff because it was something that I just was really interested in. Mm-hmm. And at about the same time I started noticing at these concerts that I was going to, these really interesting posters, not like the glossy cheap things that you normally see, but like heavy duty paper and beautiful ink. And I was really interested in that. And they were super expensive, and I couldn't figure that out either, but there was something awesome about them. And so I started looking into that. Screen printing sounded like something that would be really easy to do, which it wasn't, as it turns out. But that's kind of where I started, I guess. I started making these drawings and sending them out to bands that I was into, asking if maybe there was some way that they'd want me to do something for them. And that's kind of where I got my start with that.
You've designed screen prints for a real diverse group of artists and different groups, Lucinda Williams, Morrissey, Sonic Youth. What is the first step in creating a print and creating something that really reflects the essence of a group or an artist?
Well, that might be the hardest part, is the beginning, because not only do I have to reflect what their music is and where they're coming from that way, I've also this stuff that's like in me comes out, and sometimes that makes for like a really weird mashup, but it's good. I mean, there's like this catharsis for me, and I get to be involved with something that I love, which is music, on a really intimate level.
You seem to incorporate animals into a lot of your prints as well. What's going on there?
Well, that it seems to be my immediate fallback, just because living in Utah, growing up in Utah, being around nature, it's a really big part of who I am. And I don't know, it just seems like that's the first place I go. In thought and inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And when you have this inspiration in your mind, then you have to go to picking colors and putting it all together. Can you describe the process of screen printing for someone who's never seen it?
Well, screen printing, basically you have a frame that's filled with like a fine mesh, and you have a stencil that you develop. Then you put some ink into the screen and you push the ink through the mesh onto whatever you're printing on, whether it's a poster or a t-shirt or whatever.
So it's a very physical process.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not just doing things printed on a computer, and it does require some blood, sweat, and tears.
I wish I just had a screen printing machine that I could just send something to and they would just come out. But each of them are printed one color at a time. One at a time, over and over and over.
We're speaking with illustrator and graphic designer Travis Bone. He is designing a special event poster for our event, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, coming up in February. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about the screen printing process, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. And we'll go to the phones, and it looks like David is calling us from Salt Lake. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I had a question for Mr. Bone, the illustrator, and I was just thinking about how he's doing the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me poster, and that seems like kind of an original one as far as venue, and I wondered if he ever thought of his posters as being, you know, down the road, collector's items, how sometimes, you know, a lot of posters for concerts become highly sought after, and if he ever thought of his posters as being that way down the road. That was kind of my question.
David, thanks for the call. Travis Bone?
No. When I first started doing it, I kind of thought that it would be these individual things that would just kind of be there for a really small time. But it's interesting how some of them have you know, gone on and people want them and collect them, but that's not really something that I ever thought would happen.
That's not the foremost in your mind. You're thinking this is some sort of expression for an event or an artist,
right.
And if it happens to become a collector's item, excellent.
Sure, yeah.
Thanks very much for the call, David. 801-355-TALK is our number. Now, the Wait, Wait poster that you're designing for KCPW is not your first foray into public radio work. I understand you designed something for This American Life. Can you tell us about that project?
Yeah, actually, the first time that I worked with This American Life and with Seth Lind and Ira Glass, Ira Glass was doing a charity thing after his book came out. They had Chuck Klosterman and Susan Orlean and Malcolm Gladwell. And I did a poster for that event that was kind of a charity thing. And later on we worked on another project that was just a This American Life show poster, I guess, and we went through a whole bunch of rounds with that one, and it never actually came to fruition.
Mm.
And then later on, I did a thing. It was the Return to the Scene of the Crime show that they did, where they went out and put it in theaters for one night only.
That's the one I saw.
Yeah, that one was a lot of fun. And that was one that started out as a poster and then ended up being like a backdrop at the show and like a DVD cover and all that.
Hmm. Our time is running short, but you are designing something special for KCPW's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me event next month. Can you give us just a glimmer of what we can expect?
Well, with this project, it is really difficult to design something for a radio show, but I wanted to kind of focus on the like the call-in aspect, and so I can say that it has a girl on it and some bright colors and a telephone. And I don't know, there's still some people that need to see it, that need to sign off on things, and so it may end up having a squirrel on it or something. I don't know.
Well, we look forward to seeing it. Illustrator and graphic designer Travis Bone and designing the poster for KCPW's Wait Wait event next month. Thanks very much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Again, if you have interest in joining us for NPR's weekly quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, it's happening Thursday, February 16th at Abravanel Hall in Salt Lake City. For more information, go to our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News. Jesse Ellis is our technical director, and Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Thanks today to Tamara Kemsley. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.